Small businesses are the cornerstones of our local communities, and small business owners are hardworking and passionate people who are chasing down their ambitions while there's a lot on the line. So, let Verizon champion your small business dreams. Whether you own a small business, are scaling one, or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon, well, they've got you back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business. This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Coming up on Star Talk, we've got a Cosmic Queries edition all about exoplanets. I've got with me one of the world's experts on that subject, Anjali Tripathi. Welcome to Star Talk. We're going to find out where she came from, where she's been, and where she's going in this world of not only exoplanets, but also as a citizen scientist serving two presidents. Coming up on Star Talk.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now.
This is Star Talk. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. Today is another Cosmic Queries, ever popular format that is, on the subject of exoplanets. Chuck.
Yeah.
My co-host, how you feeling, Chuck?
I'm feeling great, man.
Feeling good about the exoplanet?
Exoplanets are always fodder for great thought, because now we know that there are millions and millions of them. They're everywhere.
I don't know if the catalog has quite hit that yet.
We went from 4. They're like, maybe there's 4.
So I know a little bit about exoplanets, but if we're going to really go in with the Cosmic Queries, we're bringing the big guns.
Yeah.
Okay? So we combed the landscape, and we found Anjali Tripathi. Anjali, welcome to Star Talk.
Thank you so much. So excited to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. You in your professional life, not only did original work on exoplanets, you also found yourself, either on purpose or otherwise, at the intersection between science and society. So I want to get to that in just a minute. Right now, you're a research associate at NASA's JPL,
lovely.
Which Chuck stands for what?
I believe Judy Paulson Lingerie.
Oh, that's right.
Judy Paulson's Lingerie. It's all the rage. No.
That's usually classified. Why'd you let that one out?
That was
out,
classified so? Information.
Yeah. Now the awesome Jet Propulsion Labs.
The Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, California. Yes. And it's not only a branch of NASA, they collaborate and are basically on the campus of Caltech, right?
Yeah. I am a Caltech employee.
Right. So who signs your checks? Is it Caltech?
It is Caltech.
Wow.
Okay, there it is. But you still have NASA overlords.
I do.
I'm pretty sure you do. You know who we had on Star Talk just when she just started?
Right.
Was the director of JPL, who is Lori Leshin. Lori Leshin. She and I served on a commission to study the future of NASA.
Well,
we were both appointed by President George W. Bush.
Nice.
And she went on to great things. And
you got stuck with me. I'm so sorry.
What a shame.
But you can dig the Lori Leshin episode out of our archives. That was fun.
Right.
I wanted to get to her before NASA got to her.
because, you know, NASA, they want to over control the interviews. And but she and I go way back.
Right.
So there was an interval where let's just rock and roll this.
Exactly.
Right? Just say what you think what you feel.
Yeah. Well, you're not going to be able to do that with Anjali because NASA is still controlling her. Sorry.
I got the NASA handcuffs on.
Okay. No. We'll figure something out here.
So at JPL, what are your primary concerns?
I like thinking about what can we see from space, right? So what can you see when you look up at exoplanets and other worlds, and also looking down here on Earth and how we can improve life here on it?
You know, people, when they think of space exploration, they don't always think that from space you can see Earth
right.
as a planet.
Exactly.
And monitor what's going on and how we doing, you know. So this seems to be a really important feature of what NASA can deliver the public.
Yeah.
Something folks always get wrong. You ask them, what's our most studied planet at NASA? And they go, Mars. And you go, wrong. And you think, it's Earth. And nobody realizes that.
Exactly.
So you still have roots back where you got your PhD?
I do, yeah. I'm a research associate at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
Okay, all right. So tell me, before we get back into exoplanets, because that's where we got all the questions are based on those.
Yes, they are.
The science and society part of your life, how did that begin?
So being a Valley girl, you know, we had an earthquake in the 90s and I had to move out of my house for a year. And the people who come on TV, for those of you who've had the pleasure of earthquakes, it's a seismologist who comes and tells you what's going to happen. And I thought, scientists can come and tell you what's going to happen next and sort of save things. I want to do that. And then I learned that seismology and geophysics and physics are important, but they don't save the world in the same way. And so thinking about how you can find connections between science and serving.
You know why they don't save the world? Because they only bring the geologists on
after the earthquake.
After the earthquake. Exactly. Not just before the earthquake. After the earthquake.
It's true.
Okay. Yeah. They ain't saving nobody.
That's a doggone shame because, like, when do we really need them? We just got some readings in. That's when we need them.
Whereas with the astronomers, we're like, that eclipse, get ready. It's coming in 6 months.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's just total predictive powers.
Yeah.
All right. So now what? So, okay. So the urge doesn't make the reality. So what happened?
I mean, I was lucky enough. I went and served in two administrations. President Obama brought me in as a White House fellow.
She was lucky.
Wow.
That was just luck.
I was going to say.
That was just luck.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like to talk about the bribes.
I served in two administrations. That's funny. I used to serve at Wendy's. I was Wendy's manager. And I served
for two tours of duty.
Two tours of duty.
Wait, so who was
Thank
your...
Thank you for your service.
Who was your first president?
I was born a while ago. Lady doesn't reveal her age, but of the two administrations...
We're going to triangulate on that if you give us enough information.
President Obama.
President Obama,
okay.
And so in what capacity were you serving in the White House?
I came in serving the U.S. Department of Agriculture, thinking about climate change. You know, it doesn't matter why your soil is dry. You got to get things to grow.
That's right.
Is there a relationship between the Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency?
I mean, so I was working on food waste, right? Which is something that both care about, right?
Big deal.
Because, I mean, you know, your apple that you don't eat turns into methane, which is greenhouse gas,
yes,
right?
Yes, without a doubt.
So
how does the Obama administration connect you to agriculture? What is that pathway?
You know, where else would you put an astrophysicist in government?
Wait, what was your title?
I was a White House fellow.
Oh, you didn't say that. Oh, okay. Right. A White House fellow. And so you have these science fellows at the White House.
So the White House fellows are actually, I was the only scientist.
Oh,
right?
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a group about, there's 16 in my class, right? So one of them is now a congresswoman. We've got all kinds of folks, a lot from the military and business and law. The idea is you go and you serve a cabinet secretary as a senior advisor.
Because the cabinet reports to the president.
Right.
So this is still a White House thing.
Exactly.
So the Secretary of Agriculture then became... Yeah,
exactly, right.
Who reports to the president and you were working with them.
So I'm intrigued by the fact that you get a PhD studying exoplanets. So you're thinking about planets, looking at them from afar.
Right.
And then Earth and agriculture becomes Earth that you're thinking about from afar. So what kind of NASA or astronomical insights can you offer the Department of Agriculture?
Well, I mean, I want it to be more down to earth, let's be honest, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea is just that, you know, you can see so much more from satellites than you can with
Walking around with a mule.
Right.
Hey, they offered to send me to estimator school where they said you're going to walk a certain number of paces in a cornfield, pick the second ear of corn you see, and count the diameter and across. And that's how we estimate the crop yields in America. We still, to this day, don't use satellite technology for the government predictions that's on ridiculous. Crop yields.
Which is Green Acres?
That's crazy.
You got Arnold the pig exactly. predicting the weather? Like,
hey.
What?
Hey, man, so how big is your corn? Like, that's crazy.
It's quantitative. You count, yeah. You know? But, I mean, it's one of those things that it's really useful for all the companies that come in because then it's calibrated ground truth,
okay.
right?
Okay. All
right. I mean, in a way, that makes sense. Yeah. So now, but isn't it much better to look at, because you can see from space, you can actually see soil conditions, you can see the crop yields themselves. There are, I mean,
how dry it is.
How dry you can see, you know, is there so much more information you can get from looking down from above. So is what's going on with that?
I mean, and so to your question, right? There is tons of NASA data that looks at the soil moisture. It looks at sort of the different vegetation. And that's all publicly available both to the agriculture department and anybody else.
And to the person pacing cornfields.
Right.
Correct.
It's available to them.
Right.
But maybe they need a job.
Exactly.
The farmer needs a job. I don't know. So I'm intrigued by this. So that was a tour of duty. It went across the administrations.
That's right.
But then you ended up, you told me offline, you ended up at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is the executive branch that oversees the budget for science in the United States.
Wow.
For science, yeah.
For science, right. And so what were you doing there?
Writing about, hey, what are we investing in? What are the people and the programs? And I figured that we added the word American in front of everything we want to do. So we wanted American health, right? We wanted
not just health.
American health.
That was smart.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, that is brilliant because when you look at Congress,
America.
You should have made it that. It's instead like, of American.
You got to spell it right. Apostrophe M-U-R-I-C-A.
Merck.
They didn't teach me that one in my spelling classes, you know.
Okay, so that was clever. And so now more people across the aisle can take ownership of it.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. No, I mean, it was, I will say, coming in to a new administration, it's kind of crazy. Your hard drives get wiped. Everything is gone. You're starting fresh a little bit. And lots of opportunity to learn. So whether you wanted me to have that opportunity or not. But I think, you know, we did some good stuff.
But would you have normally been discarded between administrations?
No.
How did you stay on?
So White House fellows have a one-year appointment that's fixed. And so started August of 2016, went to August of 2017.
Oh, you started at the end of the Obama administration.
I did.
Oh, so you crossover.
You were a part of the transition.
I was, yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Very cool. So at the time you told me again offline that you knew I was on a Pentagon board at the time. How did you know about that?
Because I go into five-sided buildings. I can handle that, not just four-sided ones.
Okay.
So.
Right on. Excuse me.
Go ahead. How many five-sided buildings do you know?
I don't know, because I work at the Hexagon. Okay.
That's top secret.
That's
why do you think the telescopes have these hexagonal mirrors, right?
The mirror segments of January Steele are hexagonal.
That's right.
So that's top secret nobody knows about except for you.
There you go. That's right. And you know where we came up with that idea? At the Hexagon. not the Pentagon.
Okay. What's your most recent published paper? Was it about climate change?
Yeah, we just wrote a paper together about sea level rise and how you can use satellite data to actually do a better job of preparing coastal cities for
excellent
rise. Yeah.
Which is where like most everybody lives.
Every major city is on a body of water.
Oh, right.
And so
what can satellites do for you? Right.
Okay, but again, it sounds like the seismologist, it's like here's what to do when the water knocks at your door. Is there preventative
advice?
No,
so this is all about how cities can look at, you know, glaciers in Antarctica and, you know, Greenland melting now to prepare for what's happening in the future, right? Rather than waiting for the level to actually rise, that you have some early warning.
Oh, so you can make predictions.
Yeah, exactly.
And anticipate. Got it.
That's amazing.
Got it. And plus, I'm not thinking about Antarctica or Greenland
exactly. When
I don't live near them.
Right.
But their water doesn't carry passports,
right?
That's right.
That water molecule go wherever it goes.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So let's get back to exoplanets.
Absolutely.
So your work for your PhD was what?
Thinking about how planets form and how they evolve over time.
Oh, formation of exoplanets.
Nice.
Good. So somebody had to make them.
That's right.
They're not just born whole.
No, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Chuck, you got questions for?
We have them right here.
Let's do it.
You want to jump right into this?
Let's do it.
All right. I love this first one. This is Monshell Hicks. And Monshell says, hi, Dr. Tyson. Hi, Anjali. Planets are evaporating? That's it. That's all that it says.
I mean, Monshell's got it down. Planets are evaporating.
Right.
Right? I mean, we got the Earth, we got exoplanets, right? Because you've got all this gas that we call the atmosphere that's trying to stick to the planet by gravity, but sometimes you got the heat from that star that's enough that it just pulls it off.
Well, like we're losing, what, helium and what's the other thing?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen and helium on a daily basis.
Hourly, minutes, seconds, yeah.
Wow. Okay, but not so fast that I should worry about it and make a thing on. But if there's stars that get brighter or more luminous and they're gas-rich
right.
planets, so they, how about those big Jupiters that are orbiting close to their host star? Are they evaporating?
Yeah, these planets, right, that we call hot Jupiters because they're so close so, in.
Right.
Right? And especially since they've always got one side often facing the star, so the same side's
because
getting
they're tidally
blasted.
Locked.
Exactly.
Like the moon is tidally locked to us.
Right.
If you get close to a massive source of gravity, it's going to lock you
right.
and only look at one side, just as we did to the moon. The moon is trying to do that to us. Did you know
just,
that?
Just lead us down the wrong path.
It's just trying
to...
Yeah, don't value judge the path.
Yeah.
It's just the orbital mechanics of it.
Come on, did we go over here? Come on, why are you... Well, come on.
I'm just saying.
Let's go over here.
So the moon is trying to slow us down, so right. we only show the same face to it.
To it.
Yeah. Right. That's why we throw in leap seconds every now and then to make up for that. But anyhow, so...
So wait a minute, with the evaporation, because I'm concerned about Earth, to be honest, what's going to happen first? Will our atmosphere, which I understand from Neil, is like thinner than the skin of an apple, okay? It's thinner than the skin of an apple. Will that evaporate before the sun expands and kills us all? Or what's going to happen first?
All right, Chuck, don't worry about it. There's a lot of things that I'll scare you with. This isn't one of them,
okay.
Right? So the idea is that you will have this atmospheric escape is what they call it, because your atmosphere is literally escaping the planet, happening more and more in the future as the sun gets brighter, but it's not all going to go away before then. So you're safe.
Okay, so...
You're good.
And we'll be crawling around the surface of the Earth trying to breathe.
Right, stay low. like you're in a fire. Stop, drop, and roll, just so you can breathe.
Well, I think you're going to want to, you know, go up towards the poles or something like that. The equator's not going to look so hot.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe it is going to look so hot.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you already got this planned out. You can have to join a Santa Claus.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
All right, what else we got, Chuck?
All right, Harry, this is TJ's show, who says, hi, TJ here from Winnipeg, Canada, eh?
He does not have that in there.
No, they don't. Okay. They do not.
Okay.
It says, thanks for taking my question. Hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Tripathi, and Lord Nice, longtime listener and new Patreon here. My question is about intelligent life. If there are roughly 10 million unique organisms on Earth, 99% of all species that have ever existed are extinct, and we are only the only intelligent species out of all of that, questionable.
Big assumption.
Then doesn't that mean that the likelihood of there being intelligent life on a newly discovered habitable world is about 1 in a billion?
Oh, I like that.
Okay, so there
he's
you go.
Fast back of the envelope math.
So he says, yeah. So, and then he goes on, our galaxy might be teeming with life, but intelligent life could be extremely rare.
So let me recast that in another way. So if you have his Earth, there's this one branch of vertebrates coming out of fish that became great apes.
Right.
Okay. I know some apes, but not all of them are great.
Well, no, some of them were just not so great apes.
So, and one thin branch of that are the humans. Anything could have stopped that.
Right.
The asteroid not taking out the dinosaurs would have disrupted the mammals from ever even, quote, ascending to where,
we are.
Just sheer luck.
Exactly.
Okay. Bad luck, dinosaur. So, if this is just one branch out of the tens of millions of life forms, if you have tens of millions of Earths, close your eyes and throw a dart. Really? Most of them will just have life like we got here.
Just life, but just it will life. Not be developed.
So react to that, please.
I'm just saying I'm not smart enough to know what else is out there in the universe and certainly not the numbers of that. So I think, if we're being honest, do we know if there's life out there? I don't know. Do I hope there's life out there? Heck yeah. Do I hope it's intelligent? Heck yeah. But the number's in a billion?
Let's take the intelligence out.
Okay.
Now, the fact is...
It's already out.
let's factor that out. What is the likelihood of just life? I don't care if it's single-celled life. I don't care if it's just, some type of bacteria, amoebas, whatever. What is the likelihood of that happening, seeing as how, the same building blocks that we have here are there. Everywhere.
Yeah, plus it happened pretty quickly on Earth.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, we're only 4.5 billion years old, and we got to the life part pretty damn quickly.
I mean, there's planets everywhere, right? Like, every star has planets. And so if you think about it, we've got so many planets, so many balls of rock are probably amongst those planets. Chances are good you had the conditions for life, right? Uh-huh. Water, some energy, those things seem like they're out there. So I think the chances are good. But again, 1 in a billion, I don't know if it's that slim.
Yeah, plus we're not even limited to rocky planets anymore because there's some good moons.
There are some great moons. That habitable worlds, right? Not just the habitable planets.
Habitable worlds, not just planets.
World. Forget planet, non-planet. Have world.
World. Okay. And then I mean, like even like an ice. Well, what would be like an ice world, like Enceladus?
Yeah, you got that underneath. Water underneath, right?
Yeah, that could happen, right?
Totally happen.
All right. Here we go. This is Dylan, and Dylan says, greetings, everyone, from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Right.
I'm taking undergraduate astrophysics courses and learning about spectroscopy. Thank you.
Spectroscopy.
Yes. It always gets me. And other amazing methods of how to find and characterize planets. What has been the best method so far to find planets, and what possible new methods are being thought up?
So let me focus that down and have you tell us, we're now using spectroscopy to study the atmospheres of these planets. So what's coming out of that?
I mean, it's amazing that when you get just the right configuration, that you've got the star and the planet passes in front of it and you're looking at that, some of the light goes through that atmosphere of that planet from the star and gets to us. And so we can actually see some of those chemicals in that atmosphere.
That's amazing.
So we see all
the chemicals are disrupting, really, the clean path of light from the star,
amazing.
And that disruption shows up in the spectrum.
They were like putting their fingers on there, getting those fingerprints.
Yeah. So what are you looking for?
So we've seen carbon dioxide with the James Webb Space Telescope, which is pretty cool. Time we've seen that on another exoplanet.
All right. Okay, what else?
All kinds of other compounds, right? We get water,
Water molecule, yeah.
Right, and you got some good things in there. And so all kinds of configurations of oxygen and carbon and hydrogen that you're thinking about.
Methane.
Methane is pretty great, right?
You get methane there too? Have you seen it yet?
There is methane about on the planets, yeah.
Okay.
Would be evidence of?
Farts.
It can be.
All right, keep going.
That is so cool. This is Cesar.
Oh, by the way, just to bring closure to that, to say that the boring, obvious fact, so many of these planets were discovered.
Exactly.
Were discovered just by their spectra.
Right, and by transits, right? That you looked at the light and you saw it blinking, and that's just because something kept going around at that light of the star.
Right.
And
the transit is the planet going in front of the star's light, rocking the star's light.
It's just like when we have eclipses where you block out the whole face of the star, but here it's just a fraction of it, right? So we talk about...
Yeah, in fact, solar eclipses are really transits.
Yes.
We're talking about the transits of Mercury and Venus.
Yeah. Mercury transit, Venus transit, it's a moon transit.
That's right.
And an eclipse, technically, astronomically, is just object moving into the shadow of another object.
Okay.
So a total solar eclipse, really, we shouldn't use the term eclipse, but we do.
All right. Yeah. Nice.
This is Cesar Erno, who says, hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Tripathi. Is the James Webb Space Telescope used to look for exoplanets?
Heck yeah.
Okay. So why don't we just zoom in on some exoplanets and get high quality?
She worked for NASA. She said, heck yes.
Heck yeah.
Heck.
We heard
heck.
That.
No, let me hear it real. You're in New York City. You're in Manhattan. Say that right.
F*** yeah! I'm sorry.
I don't think you can beat that.
I'm so sorry.
No, Chuck wins that.
I'm sorry. Chuck did that was just too New York. I couldn't
help that's a long bleep on that one. Okay.
No, I think if I had the t-shirt instead of I love New York, it would be I love GWST, right? For the exoplanets.
Oh, yeah.
James Webb Space Telescope.
So I thought it would only be looking closer at exoplanets we've already discovered. Is there a discovery mode?
There are discoveries too, yeah.
How does it do that?
I mean, it actually captures pictures where you see that there's planets in the frame.
Wow. Without knowing that in advance.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he said, why don't we just zoom in and get some high-quality images?
That's what it's doing.
I mean, that's exactly what you just said it's doing.
Wait, so you see the host star and you see the planet.
You get a hint of the planet being there.
A hint of the planet.
You get a little dip of tea, right? Dip of planets. But I mean
Wait, can GWST block the light of the bright star? So that
there is no coronagraph on GWST.
Coronagraph.
Right? So a coronagraph is the part that, it's like sunglasses for your telescope to block out the light.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
But, the question of can we zoom in on planets there? James Webb is looking at different patches of sky. And if there are planets in there, that's great. But it can't look at just any part of the sky and say, zooming in deeper and deeper, because planets don't give off a lot of light. They're just reflecting their starlight, which is so faint that you don't see it most of the time.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
All right.
All right, this is Gavin Bamber, who says, hello from North Vancouver, where plant life flourishes. And he's not lying. That's a
North Vancouver.
Ooh, it's so green up there.
Really?
Oh, you can go green blind up there. It's crazy. It's crazy. He says, once we find plant or animal life on other planets, will we be able to eat it? Or can we tell if we're able to eat it? Or for Chuck, will we be able to smoke it?
Well, that's a question for you.
Well, yeah.
Did he say that?
Yes, he did.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, I swear to God. Will we be able to smoke it? But
okay, so let me ask this. So can we only, I don't know how much biology
mm-hmm.
But can we process organic matter that has a different DNA from us? Like our DNA is right-handed, like it spirals this way.
Yeah.
Like clockwise looking up.
A double helix.
But in principle, you can have DNA doing the other direction.
Right.
It's the chemistry shouldn't matter.
Right.
Right? Except we don't.
And all those people's skin is on the inside of their body. That's how all their organs are on the outside. They are so messy looking.
So what is the scholarship on just the digestibility of life forms that are not native to Earth?
A researcher doesn't eat and tell, Neil.
A researcher doesn't eat and tell?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I don't know why that got me.
But I mean, I would say, would you want to though, right? Because I mean, there's so many things that you're like, oh, that cheese doesn't look quite right. I don't know if I want to eat that. Now you're going, I just found this out there. I foraged for some wild.
Yeah. That looks tasty. There's a whole lot of stuff on Earth you know not to eat. Now, you're that desperate to eat aliens?
Right, I'm just saying, would you want to?
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hi, I'm Chris Cohen from Haworth, New Jersey, and I support Star Talk on Patreon. Please enjoy this episode of Star Talk Radio with your and my favorite personal astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
So this is Daniel L. Thompson, who says, howdy, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Tripathi, and Sir Nice. And that's Lord Nice. He says,
Lord is above sir.
Lord, exactly.
Yeah, Lord is totally
above
sir.
Why would you demote me? Mm-hmm. He goes, I'm Daniel from high school in the AF JR ROTC, a Junior Air Force Reserve Officer Training Corps. Good for you, buddy.
Nice.
He says, for potential habitable planets, has there been a minimum and maximum size or density to define what would be survivable for humans to live?
I like that.
Yeah, and P.S. Chuck, you're welcome for the easy name. Well, thank you, Daniel. But you can't take credit. I'm going to thank your parents for that. But anyway, is there, I suppose, planet sizes and other pressure, atmospheric pressure, or gas planets, whatever, all those things would...
There was a movie, The Space Between Us, where someone grew up on Mars. An astronaut got pregnant on the night before the launch.
Yeah.
And it takes 9 months to get to Mars.
Right.
And NASA had to hide that information. So she gave birth on Mars and no one knew about it. And then the kid came back to Earth and it was like...
That's pretty cool.
He had a hard time breathing.
Yeah.
And all the things he was used to on Mars.
His
muscles couldn't handle it. But he was still alive. It didn't kill him. So do you have any thoughts on survivability of... low or high gravity?
I mean, I'm a big fan of Earth, right? So like looking for planets like Earth, because, you know, I like being able to jump up and down rather than Jupiter. I don't jump up. Where are you going next, right?
Right.
And, you know, having that nice solid surface. So, you know, something sort of the size of Earth is nice and cozy. And we seem to do okay.
Oh, wait, so your point is, if it's much more massive than Earth, it's not a rocky planet. It's gaseous.
You're getting gaseous.
Because it kept all of its gas.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so that's out. The upper end of that's
upper
out.
Upper end's out. Okay. I don't know how low we can go, right? Because we've got moons that are possibly good places to live, right?
Well, our moon is 1/6 gravity.
Right.
Right. So that's not going to kill you.
It's not going to kill you. You're going
to
get some help.
But you don't want to get used to it and then come back to Earth.
Yeah, I mean, three generations later, you know, you have the bone density of a marshmallow.
But you've got the space suit, right? That, you know, it's a souvenir, right? All I got was this lousy space suit, right, when I came. You're not going to be buying from my souvenir shop anytime soon, are you? All right, it's okay. So, I mean, I think, you know, down on the lower end, it's hard to say how low you can go. It is interesting, though, that when we look out at exoplanets, we find some where there are these little planets that actually end up just getting evaporated away. So instead of their atmospheres being all that evaporates, you got just like crumbly planet going off into space.
Wow.
Right? So you got the wrong conditions there. So it's not just the size of the planet. It's how close it is to the star and everything else it's feeling. So
it probably feels tidal forces that'll disrupt
if you get
structurally too.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so. But when they say super Earths, we've heard this.
That's right.
Among exoplanets. Super, how big is super?
Bigger than Earth, smaller than Neptune, right? It's not like anything we've got in the solar system. So you think like, that's in between.
So you might
super.
Be twice your
twice.
Gravity, something like that.
Could do, right? Times. We talk about it in terms of the radius of it. Right. So how's the size of it? Because the super Earth, right, it could have a surface. It could be a little bit more puffy.
Okay, but so how big a radius compared to Earth if it's a super Earth?
Depends on your definition, right? It's a few times.
A few times, yeah.
Okay, a few times. But that's pretty big.
That's pretty big, right?
So normally when people think of, it's twice the size, but... If you can range 10 and 100 times bigger, a factor of two is just friendly.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, we have a poster that we made of people skydiving on a super Earth because they thought, oh, that'd be fun, right?
Yeah.
You'd be falling faster.
I personally don't think
a
it
lot
would be
faster.
Fun.
Yes.
But our art team thinks it's great.
Yeah,
I think that's great. Yeah. But, you know, there was also the question in there of the density, right? And I definitely want to be on that ball of rock rather than that ball of gas like Jupiter because I like having a surface.
You want to land somewhere. Okay.
Yeah.
But what if, or could you tell this, like when we retrieved, part of the asteroid, right? We were able to do so because we put the drill down in a place where we knew it was crumbly rock. So what if we know that it's a super Earth, but it's kind of made of that composition of crumbly rock?
I mean, I would love to get to that point, right? Right now, I'm just like, it weighs this much. It seems this big. Yeah, divide some numbers.
I don't think that's a real thing.
Really?
Yeah, because if it's big enough and has a strong enough gravity,
right,
it'll
it will condense.
The problem with the asteroids, they don't have much gravity.
Right.
So they're like loosely,
absolutely.
They're loose. Plus, it didn't drill. It was a touch and go.
It was, right. It was bang. It sucked up
whatever
came up inside of it. Yes.
Right. And they were ready for just a couple ounces. Yeah. They got half a pound.
Right.
A half a pound. So they were good.
But no, you're right. The gravity makes it. That makes sense.
All right. We got time for like one and a half more questions.
One more. All right. Let me see. Okay. Let's go with Andrew Nisker. And Andrew says, hello from Flesherton, Ontario. Can you please explain the different types of biomarker gases? How will the next generation of telescopes enhance our ability to study exoplanets? Guess that's two separate questions, but hey, I'm always looking up, so I have to ask lots of questions.
Nice. So picking up on the earlier question, you mentioned water molecule, methane, and carbon dioxide.
Right.
But is there like the greatest hits of what would reveal life on the surface?
I mean, there's so many different ways that we can search for exoplanets with life, right? Those signatures, right? We call them biosignatures or technosignatures. If you even want to go a little further afield. And so the fact that, you know, you could look for pollution on a planet.
That'd be a technosignature.
Well, depending on how you count it.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Right. But I mean, like you look for chlorofluorocarbons, right? From your, you know, hairspray on your alien world.
Okay.
You know, that would be a slam dunk for life, even though it's not one of the things we've historically always studied.
Right. These sorts
of things. And so, you know, signatures like methane.
Wait, so if the chlorofluorocarbons, they're idiots.
But they're idiots we can see, right?
No sign of intelligence like there.
Exactly.
They're getting rid of their ozone layer.
Which is probably what they're saying about us when they actually see the biomarkers from this planet. Or the technomarkers from this planet. They're like,
right, I mean, it's like, if you were really smart, would you want people to see you and find you?
Right. So anymore, what's the phosphate was one of them?
So phosphine is something that people have talked about.
Excuse me.
Possibly, it's all good. Being detected possibly in Venus, and whether that's a sign of life or something else, it's probably something else there. But I think there are lots of detections of all of these more complicated molecules, right, where you start putting things together.
That would be there only if you have life on the surface.
That could be caused by life, right?
Okay.
You know, like the chlorofluorocarbons would only be caused by life. But methane could be common from something else.
Something else.
Okay, because you can get naturally occurring methane.
Right,
okay,
yeah.
So what about oxygen?
Oxygen could be there. It can be, I mean, when you
I don't know how you get oxygen unless somebody's making it, like with plants.
I mean, like, look at the history of the Earth, right? For billions of years, we've existed, and we didn't have this much oxygen all that whole time, right? Like, go back in time. So you not only need to look at that planet and just see what it is, but at this particular moment in time.
Right, because when I saw the original Star Trek, do you remember that the original Star Trek, no one ever wore a spacesuit?
No.
When they went down on
the planet. They didn't wear a spacesuit. They never wore a mask.
Right. Well, you know why? Because they would establish oxygen, nitrogen, atmosphere, Captain. Yep. Well, let's go on down.
It's a Class M planet.
Right, exactly.
Breathable atmosphere.
So I'm thinking, if you just look hard enough, you find other oxygen, nitrogen planets. And then I realized later that you're only getting the oxygen from living matter on the planet. It's not just some random mixture in the random assortment of planets. Somebody's making the oxygen. And on Earth, it's our plant life.
But I mean, we can also, you know, when you form a planet, you got all kinds of chemistry going on in there and things going into the rocks. And so what goes on in your atmosphere, some of that just happens naturally.
Okay. So you're going to have to distinguish those cases. And so getting the list is one thing. And then you fight about whether it's biological or not.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. At the conferences. Yeah, that's good.
That was a good question.
Chuck, time for one half a question.
Oh, my God. Let's see. Let's go with Captain James Riley, who says, hello, everyone. Texas here. Is there a most common atmospheric composition out there among rocky planets?
I like that. That's related to that last question.
Related to the last question.
And I think in the last question, he asked about the telescopes. And I think the answer is we need more data, right, to answer this because we haven't been able to tell the atmosphere.
I'm not allowing you to cop out and just say we need more data.
No, talk to me. But I mean, I think that's the thing is that so many of these things, because if it's a cloudy day, you can't see what's going on underneath, right? You see clouds, you see like water vapor up there, right? So there's so many of these systems where you think like, hey, I need this new telescope.
Okay, so of all the planets where we know anything about their atmosphere, is there an emergent common list?
I think it's kind of like the zoo, right? There's some common things, like there's all those things with tails, so there's all those things with oxygen, there's all those things with carbon and methane, right? It's the sort of thing that we haven't seen enough to be able to say this is the most common thing yet. So not yet.
So like the zoo, you have animals with tails, animals with four legs.
Things with wings, right? Like it's just, okay, so you start classifying them.
You start blunt.
Right.
Sure. I think what it means is we got to chat more again in a few years, and then we can do better.
Well, that means you'll come back.
I'll come back.
Well, very cool. Yeah. By the way, I understand you have a TED Talk?
I do.
Yeah, yeah. On?
On Atmospheric Escape.
Well, oh, okay.
Okay, well, I'm not watching that. I'm scared to death.
But you know that how it ends. Well, you know you're safe, right? You know how it ends.
I'll die long before. Yeah.
So you're the first to model the escape of gas from atmospheres.
Doing that in 3D for these planets.
3D modeling. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
In the old days, computers weren't fast, and we didn't have AI. And so you do like 1D modeling and 2D modeling just to approximate the 3D modeling because you couldn't calculate it. And then when computers get fast enough, and she comes along. I got this 3D,
boom,
all in.
Here you go.
And it's hard because you're modeling gas.
Right, you're just watching it flow.
Yeah. This the flow of gas in a computer model, that's not easy.
It's not let it go, it's let it flow, right?
Right, okay. But I mean, what's funny is like, isn't that like, gas is, what's that? As it, gas moves towards entropy, it's just no chaos, right? So what do you...
Somewhere in between, right? Because it was starting on the planet in the atmosphere and just blowing off into space.
Okay, so that's what you're doing. You're going from where it's, pure, it's very more stable out. And then to its instability.
Right. There you go.
Okay.
All right, we good? All right. Chuck is good till the next time.
I'm feeling better.
You feel a little better.
I'm feeling better.
I mean, you got to be feeling totally better. Right?
So Anjali, thanks for... coming up on the Star Talk.
Thanks for having me.
We'll continue to follow your career.
Appreciate that.
You know, there's still a few more presidents you can work for.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, don't slouch.
You got to get back in the White House.
I mean, I'm the exoplanet ambassador, though, right now, right? So got to go visit those exoplanets, too, eventually.
You have an ambassador title.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm NASA's exoplanet ambassador.
Oh, sweet.
Oh, my God.
That's really cool.
So do you speak at the UN?
I speak for the State Department.
The Galactic UN.
That's what
you get this week.
So when the aliens come, when they say, take me to our leader, I'll say, well, we have an ambassador.
We have an ambassador. Is that good enough?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
No, we say, we ain't taking you to our leader. Yeah. You're the ambassador is going to be what you're going to meet.
Believe me, yes. It will be a scientist or Taylor Swift.
The doctor will see you now.
All right. Well, good luck in your continued career and your ambassadorship. And we'll want a full update.
All right. Sounds good.
As more exoplanets show up and more aliens visit.
Okay.
We'll be first on the list.
All right.
Nice.
Thanks.
All right. Good. This has been Star Talk. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysics. Chuck, thanks for
always
for
a
being
pleasure.
There. All right. And as always, I bid you to keep looking up.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.